Welcome to 3. On 2, I promised that I would speak about a few important terms before we got into the logical problem of evil, and those included the idea of impossibility and contradiction and so forth. So let's look at a number of these terms that will be important in the rest of the course, but especially in the logical problem of evil. Let's start off with a very important concept, which I introduced earlier on 1, and that's the concept of a possible world. Let's go back and kind of give a more rigorous look at the idea of a possible world. In effect, a possible world is the following. Imagine you have some proposition, P. Imagine also you have another proposition, Q. And say that P and Q are different. For example, P might say, at a certain time in a certain place, there exists a Ford automobile sitting in a certain parking lot. And Q might say that at another time in another place, the planet Saturn exists. You can see that P and Q could both be true. Okay? So what you do is you continue to add. So far you've got a set of 2 propositions, now add a number of other propositions, R, S, T, and so forth. What you do is you add up until you maximize a world. You maximize propositions which go to make up a possible world. Now in any possible world, those statements that you say about the world have to be true. And, in effect, what that means is they have to be consistent with one another. Right? You can't, there's no such thing as a possible world in which, at this time and this place, there is exactly one tree that exists 30 feet in front of me. And also, at this time and at this place, it's not the case that there's exactly one tree that exists 30 feet in front of me. Either one of, at most, one of those is true, and exactly one of them, but certainly not both of them. It's impossible that there should both exist a tree and not exist a tree at the same time and at the same place. So the idea with a possible world is this. A possible world is a maximal state of affairs. That is, for any state of affairs you add to some possible world, call it W. If you add some state, S, to W, S is either included in W or precluded by W. Okay? In any world, for example, a world in which gold is a valuable metal. Okay? There's a world. Gold is a valuable metal in this world. Well, if you add the state of affair, gold's being a valuable metal, that state of affairs is already included in W, in that world. So, the world evidently is very full at that point, because it was already in there. If you added the state of affairs that gold is a useless metal and has no value, then you can't add it to that world. It's actually precluded. It's not included in that world, but it's precluded. Precluded. Because gold, in fact, is valuable in that world. What we have in effect, then, is an infinite number of propositions which are gathered together such that for any proposition you tell me, either that proposition is in that world or its denial is included in that world. Okay? That's what a possible world is. It's a maximal state of affairs. An infinite number of propositions. Such that if you tell me any proposition, it's either included in that world or it's precluded by the world. That is, the denial of that proposition is included in that possible world. Okay, now all of that philosophy talk, philosophies, just to say that a possible world is an infinite number of different propositions which refer to or talk about, describe states of affairs within a possible world. There's an infinite number of possible worlds, but only one possible world is actual. Some philosophers call the actual world alpha. So if I refer to alpha, I'm referring to the actual world. There's other possible worlds, in fact an infinite number of them, which exist, but only one of them, the actual world, is actual. Okay, there's an infinite number of possible worlds, but only one is, in fact, actual. Probably the author who has done the best job of defining possible world and so forth is, in recent years at least, is Alvin Plantinga. So if you can get a hold and read Plantinga's works, he does a good job of defining these terms. Another concept is the concept of entailment. Sometimes we say that some proposition P entails that Q. P entails Q. Now, what do we mean by that? Well, this is what we mean in the language now of possible worlds. In any possible world in which P is true, P is the case, if P entails Q, what that means is that in that world where P is true, Q is also true. So, here's an example I think will help out. If we say that P is equal to the proposition that in his 15th year, Jim Hawkins ran in the Boston Marathon, then it's certainly the case in that same world in which that is true of Jim, that Q is the case, namely, that in his 15th year, Jim ran at some time, or that Jim ran in a marathon. As you can see, P entails Q. That is, if P is true, if Jim, during his 15th year, ran in the Boston Marathon, it's certainly true that Jim, in his 15th year, ran in a marathon. Or, as I said, if Jim ran in the Boston Marathon, it certainly entails that Jim ran during his 15th year. So as you can see, we can define these logical terms, for example, the term of entailment, within the language of possible worlds. Now, let's use the language of possible worlds and talk about what it means to say that P, some proposition, P, is consistent with some proposition, Q. Okay, what does it mean when we say that P is consistent with Q? Well, here's what it means. Take two propositions that, in fact, are false in this world. Okay? Now, well, first of all, let me just say the self-evident thing, that if two things are true in this world, then certainly they're consistent. Okay? If two things are true, that means that they can both cohabit in the same region, in the same logical space, as it were. And those things can both be true. If two things can both be true in the same logical space, or in other words, in the same possible world, then they're certainly consistent, okay? They can both consist, sit together, as it were, in the same world without there being some sort of logical incoherence or logical impossibility. Let me give two examples. I'll go back to an example that I referred to or used before. Say, for example, proposition P is that in this world I have a proclivity and a desire and love for philosophy and theology, the study of those two disciplines. Say that Q is that I'm a concert pianist. Okay? P is the proclivity to study philosophy and theology. Q is that I'm a concert pianist. Now, the question is P and Q consistent? It does happen to be the case that I have a proclivity for philosophy and theology in this world, okay? So P is true. But in fact, I'm not a concert pianist. Q is false. But still we can ask, even though P is true, and Q is false, we can still ask, is P consistent with Q? That is it the case that P and Q are possible together? That is, they could both be true. That's what we mean when we say that P is consistent with Q. What it actually means, P is consistent with Q, is that there is some possible world. It may not be alpha, the actual world, but there does exist some possible world in which both P and Q are true. Okay, there is some world in which I both have a proclivity, love, desire to study theology and philosophy, and I'm also a concert pianist. It's not true in this world, but it is true in some possible world. And therefore, P is consistent with Q. Okay, try to think of your own examples and see what you can come up with, following the outline of my example. Let's look now at two important terms in philosophy in general, and that's the notions of a priori and a posteriori. A priori is the Latin phrase from the prior things. If something is known, this is how philosophers often speak, something is known a priori, or recognized a priori. Or a proof might be an a priori proof. In philosophy of religion class, we often speak of the ontological argument for God's existence as an a priori proof for God's existence. Well, what does that mean? Well, when we say from the prior things, or a priori, what we're referring to is the fact that we can come to some substantial conclusion, some desired conclusion, without or before. Notice the word in there, prior, a priori. Prior to or without sense experience. If something is known a priori, it is known without the aid of sense experience. So, for example, I know that 2, the number 2, the mathematical number 2, equals 2. I don't need to go out in the world to the laboratory to check that. I just know that that's the case, a priori. Okay? I know it because conceptually I can see that the same thing is equal to itself. I know that the whole is greater than the parts of something. With respect, not with respect to organic wholes as we studied, but with respect, for example, to the volume of a cup, say, the volume of water. Any part of the water in a cup is always less than the volume, speaking of the volume. Any part, proper part, of the water in the cup is only, speaking of volumes now, is only part, and it's less than the whole of the water. We can know that a priori, without the aid of sense experience. Now, on the other hand, we have a posteriori. Notice the word in there, posterior. It means, literally, the Latin phrase, from the later things. And so, that which is a posteriori is something which is known after or including sense experience. If I say that there's exactly 3 ants within my shoe right now, I can't know that just self-evidently. I have to go down, take off my shoe, and check it out. I have to do a visual check of that. That's something I can only, that conclusion, that there's exactly 3 ants in my shoe right now. I can only know that a posteriori, that is, with the aid, after, posterior to, sense experience. So those are some important concepts that we'll be making use of in the coming tapes. What we do now is turn to the logical problem of evil. In your notes, you can abbreviate it to LPE if you want. Sometimes that's handy to know and recognize abbreviations when you're taking notes. The logical problem of evil as a term is probably a 20th century invention. However, David Hume, the famous Scottish philosopher, whose dates are 1711 to 1776, gave what we are calling here a version of the logical problem of evil. In fact, as we'll see in Hume, and we'll read in Hume, he refers to an ancient Greek philosopher by the name of Epicurus, from which we get the English term Epicurean. Epicurus, it could well be, is the first one who came up with an actual formation of the logical problem of evil. What is the logical problem of evil, and how is it different from the evidential problem of evil? The logical problem of evil, in short, says that these two propositions, God exists and evil exists, those two, are logically incompatible. That it's impossible, given evil, that God could exist in this world. Okay, so there's a logical problem there, and thus logical problem of evil, its name. The evidential problem of evil, which you can abbreviate EPE if you want, is the idea not that evil shows that God's existence is impossible, but it takes a more modest position. The evidential problem of evil is the idea, somehow, that evil is evidence against God's existence. That is, evil makes God's existence improbable. Okay? Improbable. Not impossible, but just less likely than not, or something to that effect. What we'll see as we get into Hume and read a little bit of Hume's dialogues concerning natural religion, a work that was published posthumously, no pun intended, after Hume's death. What we'll see in there is that Hume sort of hovers between, somewhere between the logical problem of evil and the evidential problem of evil. For a while, he's dealing with the logical nature of evil, that somehow, he claims, evil makes God's existence impossible. But then later on, he seems to drop back and say that evil only makes God's existence improbable, not impossible. So, we'll see how he refers to Epicurus, whose dates, by the way, are roughly 340 through 270 BC. One thing that's also of interest about Hume is the fact that its dialogues, notice the title of Hume's famous work, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion. And the question becomes, which one of Hume's mouthpieces there is in fact representing Hume's position? Okay, now philosophers have sort of quibbled about this point, and it's not clear from the dialogues, but most probably the one that the position in of the people in the dialogues, which is closest to Hume's other points of view in his other works, is in fact Philo. Okay, so there's three people in these dialogues. There's Philo, who is the skeptic, probably Hume. There's Demea, who is the a priori theologian. Okay, remember our term, a priori. What we mean is that Demea looks less to empirical evidence and more to rational ideas and rational argumentation. The third interlocutor, his name is Cleanthes, and he is the a posteriori theologian. Okay, Cleanthes is anthropomorphic in his theology. He's more empirical. He has an eye on causal connections, interpreting present phenomena that he sees and is able to look at inductively. And he's also less rational in his endeavors, in his searches after truth. Okay. Now, I realize that it's possible that we may have different versions, different editions of Hume's Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, this book I've referred to earlier. And so, that being the case, the two sections that ultimately I'd like you to read and think about are sections or called parts, part 10 and part 11. Because we may have different versions, what I'd like to do is the following. There are, according to my count, 36 paragraphs in part 10 of Hume's dialogues. In part 11, on the other hand, there are 21 paragraphs. What I want you to do is number the paragraphs, number 1, 2, 3, and so forth, all the way until you get to paragraph 36 and finish part 10, and then 1, 2, 3, and so forth, all the way up to 21 in part 11. Then I'll refer to the different paragraphs by paragraph number. That way, if we have different editions, we'll be able to understand without worrying about the pagination involved. If you can't get a hold of Hume for some reason, just follow along. That will be okay. But certainly if you can, follow along as I refer to the different paragraphs. First, we need to see that Philo refers to Epicurus's logical problem of evil. In part 10, section or paragraph 25, Hume does this, and at that section 25, Hume says the following. He's discussing evil in the world, and he says, Epicurus's old questions are yet unanswered. Is he, that is, referring to God, is he willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent. Is he able but not willing? Then he is malevolent. Is he both able and willing? Whence, then, is evil? Hume, through the mouth of Philo, is more or less saying that Epicurus first brought about this problem of evil, and that old problem from the 4th and 3rd century BC still remains in Hume's mind, or at least in Philo's, and probably in Hume's. The idea is that if God is willing to prevent evil, wouldn't he do it? But if he's not able to do it, then we'd say that he's impotent. If he is able to prevent evil, but not willing, then we'd say that God is not all good. He's malevolent. Is he both able and willing to prevent evil? Where, then, does evil come from? Okay, so you're left with that question in paragraph 25. And so, at the end of paragraph 27, Philo again says, and refers to this, what he calls, quote, this strange mixture of phenomena, end quote. What he is talking about, of course, is the fact that there's all sorts of beauties and harmonies and music and things that give satisfaction in the world, but there's also racking pains, on the other hand. Pains which arise from gout, gravels, megrims, toothaches, rheumatisms, and so forth. Mirth and laughter may take place, but what about spleen, melancholy, discontent, superstition, and so forth? He asks, how then does the divine benevolence display itself in the sense of you anthropomorphites? Okay, he's referring there to Cleanthes, the a posteriori theologian, who has sort of an anthropomorphic tendency. That is, he tends to view God more as a super powerful man, having some of the attributes of man, but just elevated very greatly. And so we're left with Philo referring to this strange mixture of phenomena. That is, God is all good, we would therefore expect an all good world. But why do we have this strange mixture of many goods, but many evils, evils that are often devastating? Why is that the case? Now, at this point, we're working up to where in Hume's text he seems to embrace the logical problem of evil, and he seems not only to embrace it, but to present it in a positive light. So, as we continue to work, notice that in paragraph 27, in paragraph 29, Demea, okay, the a priori theologian, he refers to Philo by saying this. Okay, now once again, DeMay is a priori theologian. That is, he's going to refer to reason. He's going to think of some reason that God might have to allow the mixture. Strange at times, albeit, perhaps, the mixture of good and evil in this world. DeMay says this, about three-fifths of the way through paragraph 29, in part 10. DeMay responds to Philo, "This life, but a moment in comparison, this life is but a moment in comparison of eternity. The present evil phenomena, therefore, are rectified in other regions and in some future period of existence." He continues, "And the eyes of men, being then opened to larger views of things, see the whole connection of general laws, and trace, with adoration, the benevolence and rectitude of the deity through all the mazes and intricacies of his providence." It's interesting because Hume has Philo present the skeptical position, but in effect he has another skepticism developing between DeMea and Cleanthes. DeMea, the a priori theologian, is less empirical in nature and more of a rationalist. He refers to reason, the use of reason, to learn about God. Cleanthes, on the other hand, as I said, is anthropomorphic, is more empirical. He has an eye on causal connections and interpreting phenomena inductively. And he's less rationalistic in his approach. This is very clear in his eruption right after the quotation I just referred to, the last thought of DeMea there, in paragraph 30. Notice Cleanthes. "No," replied Cleanthes, "no, these arbitrary suppositions of DeMea can never be admitted, contrary to matter of fact, visible and uncontroverted. Whence can any cause be known but from its known effects? Whence can any hypothesis be proved but from the apparent phenomena? To establish one hypothesis upon another is building entirely in the air. And the utmost we ever attain by these conjectures and fictions is to ascertain the bare possibility of our opinion, but never can we, upon such terms, establish its reality."